Warning, Check the Locks podcast is a true crime podcast and may contain graphic descriptions of violence, murder, sexual assault, and more. Check the Locks podcast is not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome back to Check the Locks podcast. As always, I'm John Connor.
I'm Olivia Cornu.
Saying thank you for joining us this week as we dive into yet another truly terrifying true crime case. Before we get started, as always, Olivia, my studious friend, how are you? How has your week been? How you doing? You brought a snack this week for podcast time. What's been going on? How you doing?
This week's been good. You know, we had the big snowstorm that came through here, got 10 inches of snow, which was a lot of fun for a couple days. You know, we don't have the equipment to really handle the snow, so it took the companies that came down to help us from, I think, Indiana to shovel our snow and plow the roads and whatnot. We were shut down for like a day or two, but fun days in the snow. It's now almost 70 degrees today, so there's no more snow. Never looked like a blizzard came. Just been doing a lot of studying, working, passed a few tests today. Pretty That's excited awesome. About that. How about you?
Very proud of you. I also thought it was really funny because you were like me the first couple of years that I lived down here. I was like, oh, it only snows every once in a while. And so you sent me, you know, videos of you shoveling with a broom, just being like, I'm sweeping everything off. And I remember like we got our first real bad snow when we lived in this house. And I took one of the lids to one of those like 30 gallon plastic totes, and I was just using the lid like a shovel.
Yeah.
Last year I was like, that's it. I'm buying a shovel. Like, I'm going to make sure I got everything good. But
This was like a once. We had a nice storm a few years back, but I don't think they've had snow like this since like 1960 something. So like 60 years or so. So this is, I'm not investing in a snow shovel. I left that in Iowa. I left my ice scraper in Iowa. However, I could have used that one day here a few years back, but nope. I'll stick to my broom. I had my regular garden shovel, but that thing kind of freezes up a little bit, so it's not really ideal. But we survived.
Well, I'm glad that you survived Snowmageddon, that you're hanging in there and everything's going fine. I'm also really excited because I don't know if the listeners know this, but next month is my 40th birthday.
And he's old.
Yeah, I'm super old. But my wife is actually throwing a big old party for me, and we weren't sure if you were going to be able to come and hang out, and it turns out you're going to. So that means for the first time since we've started this podcast, we're going to be in the same room together.
I know, which is going to be insane. And sadly, listeners, we won't have time to record a podcast together like we've always planned on doing, because I have to literally fly there and fly home, but I am not going to miss it.
Well, and it means the world. I'm super glad that you are coming, and you know, you can get a feel of the town, and then we can book something later and do some like in-person episodes and stuff like that. But
and y'all gotta come down here. Yeah. I hate to say come in the summer when Millie's out of school, but because it's just so hot, but you gotta come here.
Yeah, we definitely want to. It's when you've got a kid to travel stuff, like we have a trip to Florida at some point, like in the beginning of the summer, and just the logistics with that and making sure you have everything for the kid and everything. It just ends when you're traveling with a kid, it just ends up being way more than when you're traveling, you know, just two adults. So, but we will definitely make it down there. And like I said, I'm just super excited you're coming. We're gonna have to take a bunch of pictures, kind of show people that we're, you know, actually able to be in the same place at one time. So I'm just super excited about that.
I know, I'm pretty pumped. I can't wait to be there. And it's going to be here before we know it.
I know. Kara was really excited too.
She's excited. I know. I'm just so excited. I don't know. Y'all are my friends that I've never hung out with.
I know.
I just want the listeners to know that John has an audience tonight. There's a live studio audience behind me tonight.
Yeah, I am currently looking at Olivia, and on the desk or on the bed behind her, her dog and her cat have come and they're wrestling each other. So if you hear any strange noises, that's what's going on. But they're just getting cozy. Normally I never see them because they don't hang out, but they're just chilling today. So if you hear any kind of crazy noises, just know it's our live studio audience. Well, you know, speaking of your, you know, once in a lifetime snow and going back to the 60s, that is actually where our case is going to take place for this week. So, you know, I like going back in time, finding some of those older cases. And I'll be 100% honest with you. I had not heard of this at all. And so I'm interested to see if this is anything you're familiar with or, you know, any of our listeners have heard of it before. But again, definitely going back quite a bit. And I will say, you know, it wasn't when I started researching it, I honestly thought it was going to be longer. It's not as long as I thought it would be, but there's a lot of really good details in it. I think it's a really interesting case. So if you're cool, what do you think? Should we just, you know, jump into it, break it down? What do you think?
Yeah, let's get started.
All right, let's do it. For this week's case, we're headed to Odessa, Texas in 1968. On October 19th, Linda Cougat was washing clothes at a local laundromat. Linda was 24 years old and worked at a local watering hole called the Bowler Bar. She was also the mother to a six-year-old boy. But sadly, the 19th of October would be the last time that anyone would see Linda alive. While doing laundry, the woman seemed to vanish without a trace. She would be reported missing 2 days later, and police would discover her car along with her half-finished laundry at the laundromat. A search for the missing mother ensued, walking through drainage ditches and empty lots, but nothing turned up for weeks. Then, on Sunday, December 15th, 1968, the search would come to a tragic end. The body of Linda Cougat was found in an empty pasture. Two nylon stockings had been used to bind her arms behind her back. A third was wrapped tightly around her neck. According to the medical examiner, Linda had been dead for at least 8 weeks, and an autopsy would reveal that she had died by strangulation. Now, at the time police located the remains, Linda was wearing shorts and a blouse, but her underwear was found in the pockets of those shorts. Detectives theorized that she had been forced to undress and was sexually assaulted. They believe the killer then had her put her clothes back on before taking her life. Linda's friends, family, and acquaintances were interviewed, but the police had no real leads. Now, on November 5th, a little more than a month before Linda Cougat's remains were discovered, police were dealing with another murder. Dorothy Smith, a local hotel owner, would be discovered shot to death in her Monahans, Texas apartment. Like Cougat, Dorothy's hands had been tied behind her back, only this time a power cable from a television set had been used. Now, both women had been found with their hands bound together, but the cause of death was different, and the two cases were not immediately linked. Things would go quiet for a while, but on July 16, 1970, another victim was discovered. This time, it was 26-year-old Eula Miller. Eula was a go-go dancer at a local spot called the Tempo Club, and when friends hadn't seen or heard from her in a few days, they grew worried. So they decided to check in on their coworker at her Odessa apartment. But when they arrived, they made a gruesome discovery. Eula's lifeless nude body lay in her bare bed. She had been stabbed twice in the head and twice in the chest. The police were called and they immediately secured the scene. The apartment wasn't in any kind of disarray, and the murder weapon was nowhere to be found. And again, police had no real leads. Then, on January 9th, 1971, another woman was reported missing. This time, it was 24-year-old Ruth Maynard. Ruth was the wife of a local police officer named Jack. The couple were parents to a 1-year-old baby girl and a 4-year-old son. Now, on the night that she went missing, Jack had left for his 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. patrolman shift. This would be the last time that he would see his wife alive. Ruth told their nanny that she had to run out, but she would return shortly. And she would last be seen at a North Odessa night spot called the Shadow Club. The car she was driving would later be found parked there. Now, Ruth was supposed to meet a friend at another spot called the Stardust Club, but she never arrived. Like Linda Cougat, a search would be organized. And on February 15th, 1970, her body was discovered. again in a pasture, only a little over 2 miles away from where the body of Linda Cougat was found. Ruth was discovered partially clothed, and like Cougat, a stocking was knotted around her throat. It was at this point that the authorities finally began to believe that they were searching for a serial killer, only that term actually hadn't been invented yet. In fact, on February 17th, the Odessa American, the local newspaper, published an article titled "Psychopathic Killer Feared Responsible." Police also believed that their killer was, quote, a sex fiend. So, Olivia, before we go any further, what are you thinking? Where's your head at?
Yeah, so this case, we're going back to the 60s and the 70s. But I feel like for it to be a true serial killer case, I thought we would have already like heard of it. You know, we do these lesser known cases and we try to stay away from like the big, you know, Golden Gate and Gacy's and, you know, all those big name serial killers that have all the TV shows. But I'm surprised we haven't run across this.
Yeah, I was kind of feeling the same way when I was going through and doing the research, specifically because it is so brutal, right? Like these women are found bound, you know, one of them was shot. The other one is like strangled with a nylon stocking. And, you know, it's happening over years, right? So at this point, we're looking at four victims. It's happened over a couple of years. You would think something like this would kind of be in the lexicon a little bit more than it is. But that's what I was saying when I went through, I was like really surprised that I had never heard about it. And I don't know if it's because, you know, it was just in a, like, you know, a small town, Texas at that time, but you know, it's just really, really strange. And I keep thinking too about, you know, this was in this paper, like I was looking at all these archives because this case, because it is kind of so old and not as well known, to really put the story together, I had to look. I mean, if you look at the list of sources for this episode, there's, you know, I think like 10 or 11. So I was going through and looking at old newspaper articles, and you can kind of track how this Odessa American paper was writing about each one of these and how the tension or the fear in the area just was kind of rising. Cause it's, mm-hmm, you know, just cool. These women who are disappearing or turning up dead. It's, you know, it's very strange.
I like these older cases, and I like, you know, I don't know if this is going to be one that has been solved recently or if it's something that gets solved then, but I really like, it's crazy how like DNA wasn't around and the police forces didn't communicate. And nowadays it's like, you can't even walk outside without being seen on a street camera. So I think it's fascinating how people truly use their detective skills to piece these crimes together and solve these cases.
Yeah. And it is, like you said, I think it's just a sharp contrast between the time that this took place and the time that we live in today. You know, again, this is where, you know, the term serial killer wasn't really used in print until like 1981 in the New York Times. So, you know, this is just back when it would be, I guess, classified as like a mass murderer or something like that. And they're calling him, you know, like this, like lust killer, right? Where now we know he'd be more of like a hedonist, right? Like it's like the sexual excitement of doing something, but they're just like, he's a sexual pervert. And, you know, it's like all of these terms that, you know, have now been replaced with what we know again in like the pop culture, like the lexicon of the world that we live in now. Right. So it's just, you know, detective agencies, police agencies didn't work together the way that they do now. There's no computer systems. And this happened so long ago that there was a completely different vernacular for what we were calling these people. And I always find that very, very interesting.
Yeah, I agree with all that.
Well, what do you say? You want to keep going, see how this one shakes out?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, let's do it. Now, on January 17th, 1971, another woman, 26-year-old Gloria Green, would be reported missing from her job at O&L Well Service. Detectives didn't know it, but as they searched for the missing woman, they were about to get a major break in their case. You see, in December 1971, a man was arrested for jumping Bond in Aztec, New Mexico. This man's name was Johnny Meadows. Now, Olivia, I tried to look into Meadows' background, and I really couldn't find much other than he was from Texas. He was born in 1937, and he had worked in the oil fields in his home state. Now, while he was in jail in New Mexico, Meadows had actually begun bragging about murders that he had committed while living in Texas. Sheriff A.M. or Slim Gabriel got wind of the claims and traveled to New Mexico to investigate them. During questioning, Meadows told Sheriff Gabriel that he would be happy to give him the location of Gloria Green's body on one condition. He would need to help out his wife financially. The sheriff agreed and paid the woman $2,000 from his own pocket, and it was then that Johnny Meadows began his confession, starting with directions to a vacant lot in South Odessa, telling the lawman that he would find Gloria Green's body in that exact location. Now, Texas investigators were dispatched to the area, and sadly, Gloria's body was found decomposing underneath an old mattress, only a stone's throw away from a local junior high. The skeletal remains still donned the green dress that Gloria was wearing on the day of her disappearance, eyeglasses still on top of the decomposing skull. But the definitive identification would come from a local dentist who had worked on Gloria's teeth. In 1972, Johnny Meadows would plead guilty to murdering Gloria Green. He was sentenced to 99 years in prison. Deputies also announced that Meadows had signed confessions in the deaths of Linda Cougat, Dorothy Smith, and Ruth Maynard. Charges would be filed in the Cougat and Maynard cases, but Meadows would later claim that he had been coerced into confessing to those crimes. Sadly, those indictments were dismissed in the summer of 1973. Now, 10 years after his initial sentencing for the murder of Gloria Green, Meadows was up for parole for the first time. But Sheriff Gabriel was there to testify in opposition, warning that Johnny Meadows would kill again within 48 hours if released. Ultimately, his parole would be denied. So, Olivia, that's this week's case. What are you thinking? Where's your head at?
This is a wild case. I don't know. I still don't get how we didn't hear about it, but I'm glad you found it. And, you know, I'm glad that he got caught and that he ended up, whether he truly confessed or was coerced into confessing, I feel like the guy did it. And I'm just glad that these families were able to get some justice for their loved ones, because some of them had been missing for quite some years, you know. And I assume that Odessa is a small town, and so to have two murders that happened back to back of these two young women, I feel like that would put some sort of like hostile environment where you're afraid, and you know, you don't, if you're that age and a woman, I would be afraid to walk the streets. You know, you don't know what's making these women go missing. And so I'm just glad that they were able to catch him.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because, you know, if he wouldn't have confessed to it, right, if he wouldn't have been running his mouth off in a completely different state, I don't know if police, especially back then, ever would have actually caught him.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know that he's at least guilty of Gloria Green, because he was able to be like, this is where her body is. But then was like, you know, well, I was coerced. You know, they forced me to sign the confession, you know, for the other murders, where it's like, yeah, man, but they're so similar. And you were like talking about multiple murders. You know what I mean? It just makes sense. Now, I guess there was an author who came along and kind of like discredits Meadows' story and tries to accredit these murders to someone known as the Texas Strangler. But apparently this guy like tried to rope in murders from like completely different areas of Texas to kind of pad it for this book, like the count for this book. The other really strange thing too is that there was a story of another woman who was kidnapped from her home while her two children slept in her bed, and she was murdered as well. And they originally thought that it was Johnny Meadows who was responsible for that, and they were, you know, trying to put that on him. And I left that one out because somebody took credit for that later and was caught and was charged. But at the time, they were like, you know, we think you did this one too. So that was one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this case, was like, there's obviously some level of guilt and some level of culpability, but because of when it happened. And again, like, you don't have that DNA testing and you don't have, you know, the forensics like we have now. It's really interesting to see, like, the way police had to try to work it, you know, and really a lot of it, you know, for the victims that he didn't plead guilty to, a lot of it was, you know, I would say evidence-based assumption, but it's still assumption nonetheless, you know what I mean? So it's, I don't know, I would imagine it'd be hard to be a detective working this case or a sheriff working this case, you know, in 1972 and be like, I just got to figure this out, you know?
Yeah, I forget that he was talking about it in the jail cell. And so I'm glad that whoever turned him in or how that came to fruition, I do think that played a big part in it. But I just love when these cases get solved in real time, in the time before all of the cool stuff we have that solves crimes, like 23andMe.
Yeah. There's something about, like, that old school detective, you know what I mean?
That's that, like, I really like. I think that's what draws me to true crime, is like, oh, you're really solving a problem.
Right. And I think that's a good call out too, because, you know, like, if you were an old school detective, yeah, I have a friend who is a police officer here in Murfreesboro. And he was telling me, like, they had shown up to this call and it looked like the woman, you know, had been murdered. Like, she was found in her bathroom. There was broken glass everywhere. It, like, they were like, oh yeah, somebody very clearly murdered this woman. And he's, you know, like a patrol officer, one of the first on scene. And then the actual detective showed up and they were like, nope, this was a complete accident. Like, this lady slipped. She was in the shower. Like, you can see where she slipped here. This blood, like, this line of blood here indicates that she fell. She cut her, you know, you can see from this piece of glass how that matches up with this. And they're able to put this puzzle together almost real time in a lot of cases, where, you know, especially back then, we didn't have, like, the cheat codes that we have now, right? And, you know, I'm sure it wasn't always 100% accurate. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of the price you pay, where it's like, well, maybe we thought we knew and we didn't, and the wrong guy went to prison or something like that. But, you know, the fact that even if you're right, you know, 75-80% of the time, like, to have a mind that works that way, that can kind of piece things together, is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And that's cool that your friend's like, oh yeah, they completely were like, nope, this is something completely different. Because they just, they know it and they see these crime scenes. And I do think that's what draws me to crime and true crime, is just solving the problems. It's like being in an escape room. You have to critically think and you have to think about it and you have to be able to figure it out.
Well, and I imagine it's a lot like nursing too, right? Where it's like, there's something going on. It could be, you know, 100 different things. We have to figure out the one thing that it actually is, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's almost, you know, like, if you're into puzzles, or it takes a certain kind of brain, I think, to be able to do something. Way. Yeah. And excel at it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we're talking deadbolt tests, where does something like this fall for you?
A 9.
All right. Elaborate, please.
Young women getting murdered.
Just disappearing. Said.
Yeah, just disappearing and getting murdered and sexually assaulted. That are all, I would say, about my age, but they aren't. But, you know, young women just, no, it's just such a vulnerable time. And to think that it was happening back then, it still happens today. It's just sad. Yeah. It's a 9 for me.
Yeah, I think I'm going to put it up there too. I think I would put it in 9 as well. And not that I'm worried about anything happening to me, but I think the one thing that, like, really stuck out to me or got under my skin with this is the fact that, like, these people, these victims all had people who loved them, right? Like, Jack Maynard was going to work and was like, I love you, honey. Like, I'll see you when I get home at 7 a.m. He never saw his wife again, you know?
And he's a cop.
Yeah. And, you know, Linda Cougat was like, I'm going to do some laundry at the laundromat, and, you know, left her 6-year-old son, you know, with a babysitter, with her parents or something. It didn't specify, but, like, her son wasn't with her. But, you know, just went to do laundry and never came home, you know. And I've got women in my life that I love, you know, my daughter, my wife, you, right? If anything ever happened to you, I would be, you know, devastated. You know what I'm saying? So it's like the idea that you can just kind of disappear, you know, and again, I think now it'd be a lot harder, right? Because that laundromat would have 30 cameras and
right. you'd see who's coming and going. Can't walk down the street anymore without being seen or drive your car.
Right. But, you know, there's still people who manage to just fall off the face of the planet. You know what I mean? And nobody knows what happens. And so I think for that reason, I would probably put it up at about a 9.2 because it's just, you know, scary to think that you could be here 1 second and then they're finding you like 8 weeks later, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's terrifying.
100%. Well, that is where we fall on the deadbolt test for this week's case. Olivia and I are both coming in at 9s, but as always, we want to hear from the listeners, the locksmiths. Where does the Odessa lust killer, Johnny Meadows, fall on your deadbolt test? You can let us know. Reach out to us on Instagram at Check the Locks Pod. You can find us on Twitter at Check the Locks. And if you're not in our Facebook group, what the heck are you doing? Come hang out with us. We'd love to get the opportunity to get to know you, spend a little bit of time with you. And don't forget, we would love to hear from you, the listener, the locksmith. You can do that a couple of different ways. You can leave a Spotify comment. You can send us an email at contact@checkthelockspod.com. If you'd like to, you can call in and leave us a voicemail. You can give us a call at 615-920-9393. Again, that's 615-920-9393. If you want to hear a little voicemail greeting from Olivia and myself, you can go ahead and give that a call. But also, we love reviews. They really do help us. So Olivia, if somebody wants to leave a 5-star Apple Podcast review, what's the best way to do that?
They need to go to the Apple Podcast app, go to our show's homepage, scroll down where you see all 5 stars, click all 5 stars, and leave us a little bit of love. Tell us what you think about the podcast.
That's right. And Olivia always says it best, so I don't have to. Apple Podcasts, click those stars. Let us know what you think. We would love to read those reviews on the show. And they help us so much. They help us get into other shows' recommendations. They help new listeners find the show. Again, we're only a couple of reviews away from 200. So if you haven't left us a review, we'd love to read it on the show, and it would greatly help us out. And if you like what we do, you want to help financially support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron. Head over to patreon.com/checkthelocks. You can get signed up today. We got a lot of great tiers, exclusive benefits. We got stickers, coffee mugs, stuff like that. But you also get the episodes commercial free. So if you love Check the Locks, but you hate those ads, then Patreon is the way to go. So again, you want to help us keep the lights on, throw us a few bones. That's patreon.com/checkthelocks. You can get signed up today. If you can't financially support the show, we definitely understand. Just listening, hanging out with us, and sharing what we do with your friends and family, the people who are important to you, mean just as much, if not more. So that's you. You're listening. You're telling people to check out the show. Just know that we appreciate it so much. That's going to, again, help us find new listeners, bring new members into our community, and really just get the word out there about the podcast. So, again, if you are sharing this in any shape or form, just know that we appreciate you more than we could ever tell you. That's all that we have for this week's case, but please make sure that you're subscribed to Check the Locks on your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. We will see you again next week with another truly terrifying true crime case, but until then, don't forget to
check the locks.
See you next week.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.